Hey, Sens fans, this is Stuntman Stu, and you're listening to the Six Sens Podcast. Say that six times fast.
All right, welcome back, Sens fans, to the Six Sens Podcast, second week in a row. I'm here with Graham and the man whose high-pitched voice has become very legendary on the show. Tim, you're back. Good to have you.
Turn down the volume, turn up the treble, boys. How are we all today?
Not too bad.
Good.
Not too bad.
Still haven't changed your shirt since St. Patty's Day, eh, Graham?
No, still rocking it.
Beautiful.
I know.
Looks nice. That lovely Kelly Green that can blend into a retirement community in Florida or in a bar on St. Patty's Day.
Reminds me of the faded green we used to wear landscaping, just that ugly, washed out green.
Like toothpaste green, eh?
Oh, yeah, like the Crest stuff from the 80s that should have been pulled off the market. Anyways.
Gentlemen, lots to talk about, especially the amazing contributions of Francis Lessard to the offensive explosion of the Ottawa Senators lately.
Of all the things that we have to talk about, we're going to start with Francis Lessard.
Of course. We have our priorities straight.
Well, okay, I'll start it off with Lessard. Can anyone else here think of any other event in history in which 3 minutes had made such a massive difference to the performance of one athletic club? I mean, Lessard's just been dominating. I mean, a few minutes ago, Francois, you were just recalling his most recent fight against AHL mediocre scrapper DJ King in the offensive zone.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was just when Graham and I actually went to the game together, the Washington game on Friday together. Like, Ottawa was playing decent, and we sort of had set up shop in the offensive zone, kind of start the cycle and stuff like that. And next thing you know, like, Meathead decides he's going to, you know, he wants to scrap it up in the offensive zone when we're getting, like, some decent offensive pressure. And it's just like, Graham and I kind of looked at each other. We're just both, like, shaking our heads.
And then he just hung on for dear life.
I think at the time, the Senators player, I forget who it was coming in from behind the net on, like, a wraparound attempt. And the whistle had blown because Lessard's hugging another guy in the corner.
I love all the talking heads on TV who talk about, like, you know, the reduced role of the goon in the NHL going forward, how these players have to get smarter, how they have to be able to play the game. And then Brian Murray, bring him on up. Francis Lessard, he's going to destroy all those talking heads, little ideals about how the game should be played.
He's been the catalyst up here.
Oh, definitely. It's absolutely his leadership and the energy that he brings to the table that's really been the difference, I think.
Well, throughout his entire career, he's been known as just the most amazing guy in the world in the dressing room, right? I mean, that's what he's known for.
Right.
So, of course.
Exactly. Like, whenever a guy can't do anything else to save his life, he's amazing in the dressing room. That's how he manages to stay around the game.
And as a reward for his efforts, now he's no longer playoff eligible for the AHL playoffs, even though he's played, what, the bulk of the season down there?
He's got his ticket punched already.
But it's funny, though.
Or maybe ticket hugged, I don't know.
We were talking about this earlier, Tim, and you kind of brought up a good point where you think maybe the organization is, like, counterintuitive, or this seems kind of weird, but they're burying him in the NHL.
Yeah, exactly. Well, exactly. Karkner's gone out of the lineup for the rest of the year, so they got to have, I guess, Chris Neal and the other, you know, tough guys on the Sens. Can't quite get the job done, so up comes Frankie, right? And he's done a fantastic job. Obviously, the intimidation factor's been there. The Senators haven't had a lot of fighting majors since the, you know, blow-up of the team. So I'd like to single-handedly thank Francis Lessard for intimidating the other team so well. And, you know, Brian Murray pulling just another great trick, burying guys in the NHL. You know, the AHL product's what we care about this time of year.
He just keeps pulling rabbits out of his GM hat, eh?
Lots of good stuff.
But you know what's kind of funny, though, is you're saying this guy plays 3 minutes a game, and I've always been in general kind of, I'm getting so sick and tired of fighting in the NHL, but I find it interesting how a guy like Francis Lessard can play 3 minutes a game. And in any other sport, like you look at, for example, the NBA, someone who comes off the bench 3 minutes a game is expected to make some sort of contribution one way or another, like whether it's like a three-point specialist like Steve Kerr used to be with the Bulls, where the guy would might have played, you know, all of 6 minutes a game, but he was expected to knock down those two or three shots when the ball was put in his hands. Like, the fighter really has no utility whatsoever in hockey compared to in other sports, when you look at guys that are in limited roles but still expected to make massive contributions when they do play. So I just think it's kind of an interesting phenomena that we're seeing here.
Yeah, and you can't even use the argument that, you know, guys like Francis Lessard are goading somewhat legitimate minute eaters in the NHL, like third line plus guys, and dragging them off the ice with them. He's not. I don't really think a lot of enforcers in the NHL these days have that capability unless you know, kind of have an edge to your game and you're a star player. Like, you're not even doing your own team any favors by taking another asset off the ice. Just like when Chera was here and he used to fight, you know, there was always the controversy about whether or not we should have guys like Chera fighting. You know, is it good for him to be dragged off the ice for that long, risk of injury, which hampered us once quite badly, if I recall.
It seems like the league is actually turning itself towards like those middleweight fighters, though. Guys like Zach Smith, who dropped the gloves on Friday night in a little scrap with Matt Bradley, and he kicked the crap out of him and bloodied him up. But even like Chris Neal, there are a ton of other players around the league who can actually like make contributions in other facets of the game. And we've kind of seen, like, even like you look at Derek Bugaert's contract with the New York Rangers this offseason. You know, he signed for what, like $1.6 million per season? And that was regarded by many around the league as like the worst contract handed out last summer. So,
yeah, I see it as a real, you know, it's a real double-edged sword, right? You got the NHL trying to advertise itself as this family league or, you know, family entertainment. Everything from the jerseys, you know, promos, kids clubs, all this stuff. Yet they still, you know, basically encourage fighting or allow it. And I guess that could be, you know, determined as encouraging it. And, you know, that whole headshot basket as well. Just really interesting to see where the NHL's priorities lie. It seems like there's like almost like an unspoken underbelly that they just kind of hope kids will grow into. But, you know, when I'm at work and I'm talking to people about hockey, one of the things that comes up constantly is, well, I don't like my kids watching the fights. I have a hard time discussing them, telling them that these guys are athletes, so they're allowed to fight. But as soon as you do that anywhere else but the rink, you're arrested and charged.
Well, and it's really interesting too, right? Because, and if we sort of link this up to the whole what's going on with headshots right now, and really no one has any idea what's going on with headshots right now. And it's really interesting because baseball was painted with a black eye for the steroids, which, and I refuse to believe that steroids are not rampant in every other professional sports league, but baseball took the necessary measures to try and rectify that problem.
And it was embarrassing for them.
Exactly. And then, of course, you know, baseball gets, you know, the whole umpiring and no use of instant replay. And, oh, this is a dinosaur, you know, league that doesn't use instant replay to make the right call, blah, blah, blah. So what do? They implement some measure of instant replay to help reverse calls. But time and time again, we see these things where, you know, Gary Bettman and is put on the spot about some of these pressing issues that are related to the development of the game and trying to make the game more appealing to the public. And it's just like there seems to be this general attitude where it's like, well, it's hockey and it's just part of the game and we have to deal with it and blah, blah, blah. It never seems like there's any sort of owning up to, yeah, headshots is, you know, like we're going to take some measures and this is it. So I don't know. It's kind of discouraging in that way where it's almost like it's not really a laissez-faire attitude, but it's like there's almost like a, I don't want to call it a superiority complex, but it seems like there's this attitude in terms of when we're talking about the NHL and hockey where it's like, well, it's just it's a different game altogether and people don't understand and you know what I mean? Like it's just happening so fast and blah, 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 blah. Bullshit. Like anyone else have any thoughts on that?
Or? Absolutely. Let's talk about Gary Bettman basically passing off all of his job duties to Brendan Shanahan-led committees. Like, why isn't Brendan Shanahan the commissioner of the NHL? What kind, like, why is he so, all these committees, like, you know, Rob Blake, these competition committees, these all-star committees, all this garbage. What's Gary Bettman doing apart from, you know, trying to prop up Phoenix?
He's doing a good job of that, too. That's just a fucking disaster in the desert.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Well, and then the only way it can get worse, and this is going to sound really bad and unpatriotic and Don Cherry is probably going to try and hunt me down for saying this, but the only way that situation could get worse is if they actually move the team to Winnipeg. Well, Winnipeg is, I mean, as much as Phoenix is not a hockey market in terms of getting fans out to the building, economically, it's way more viable to have in terms of getting corporate sponsorships. And the fact that the team is not getting corporate dollars, okay, fine. You know, that's probably because the product is not well aligned with the market down there. But Winnipeg is not an economically viable center to put any major professional sports team into. Let's be honest with ourselves here.
I hate to say it, but you know, it's been said a number of times, the Jets left for a reason in the first place. If they come back, is it going to be more of the same? I mean, what changed? A lot of other franchises survived those tough years when during relocation. Ottawa was able to bail itself out from bankruptcy. If someone thought that Winnipeg was a viable market for NHL hockey, that team probably would have been propped up again.
The strength of the Canadian dollar has a lot to do with that as well.
Yep, yeah, that's true.
And it's actually kind of be kind of interesting over the next couple of years. Like, if that Canadian dollar ever kind of like goes back to where it was a few years ago, it's going to be interesting to see where the league revenue goes, because I think a lot of the corporate dollars are, like, obviously the league's making a lot of revenue because the cap keeps going up on an annual year. But like, once that revenue drops from Canada, if that dollar ever depreciates, like, the league could be in serious, serious trouble.
Yeah, I think, I was talking to a friend, I forget where he saw this source, but I think the NHL is one of those situations where you essentially have like 30% of teams driving like 70% of revenue. And you can imagine what that 30% of teams is. Toronto, Montreal,
Detroit,
New York,
Boston.
And then like the balance of the other Canadian teams probably. So you have 30% of your teams driving 70% of revenue. Like that just... That's not stable.
It always kills me that the NHLPA doesn't step up and say, you know, we want these teams moved. We want them moved to profitable locations, because ultimately it's going to help their union members, right, by driving up their contracts with the increase in the salary cap. And it's always, I'm just amazed that they can sit back and say, you know, the team probably should stay in Phoenix, blah, blah, blah. They should be weighing in on these issues as well.
I'm actually kind of surprised they haven't tried to put a team in Seattle since the Supersonics have left. Because, like, Washington State, that's a market where they've had, what, like, Spokane. They have the Seattle Thunderbirds in junior. Like, they have a lot of, they have some junior hockey out there. I'm not too sure, like, how well those teams draw in terms of fans. But, like, I don't know. That's a market that's really kind of untapped.
I think it's a very similar market to that of Vancouver. Obviously, very close. Recently, we saw in MLS soccer, I don't know if anyone listening to this show will give a, you know, iota but what I'm about to say, but you know, the Seattle Sounders came into the MLS league last year, had absolutely wonderful success, 30,000 plus attendance sellout. They've become the new gem of the league for attendance, much like TFC was during their initial four-year run. And now in Vancouver, same thing, MLS has arrived, same kind of response as Seattle. Seattle's been able to sustain football, all the same sports that
a good
place
sports
like
down.
Vancouver has. I don't know anything about their collegiate sports there.
Well, Washington State does particularly well.
Yeah, and I think the issue with the Supersonics, if I'm not mistaken, it wasn't it wasn't fan base and demand related issues.
Ownership.
It was the building and ownership. Yeah. So that's sort of like, I think that there's a city that could definitely, an American city that I think could be a viable NHL market, and it's got that climate sort of conducive to having a fan base that sort of looks forward to hockey in and around the time of year that hockey is played, I guess you could say.
Absolutely, and all the Seattle sports markets dry up as soon as the Super Bowl's done, right? If Seattle can ever make it that far.
What about Portland?
I think Portland's kind of...
That's a basketball crazy market, right?
Yeah.
From what I understand about Portland, it used to be a pretty rough town. I think nowadays it's kind of like hipster-driven, like Brooklyn. Just a bunch of people who like to walk around like they earn $80,000 a year, but actually make, $15 working at Wendy's, but dress like it. I don't know what kind of market there is for a team there beyond the Trailblazers.
I don't know if you have the population to support more than one professional sports franchise.
Well, they have the Timbers as well in the MLS, which and they used to be a PDL team or whatever. Just like Montreal Impact or the White Caps, but they're MLS now too. So they're growing. I have no idea, though. I don't think you could support that many teams up and down the West Coast.
No.
Especially with alignment issues and everything. Like, perhaps if you called the team, like, the Washington whatever, Washington State whatever, like, you know, Florida, you could maybe appeal to people in Oregon, but who knows.
Getting back to the Ottawa Senators. Switching gears.
Oh, yeah.
That was a long intro on just the NHL in general. Daniel Alfredsson is on this little three-game tour with the Ottawa Senators. There's the possibility that he could come back and play a game this year just to test his ailing back, find out where he's at in his recuperation. And what do you guys think about his return? Are you excited?
Is it necessary?
Well, that's another question that should be addressed.
Well, I guess it all depends on his motives. If he wants to come back and try and skate with it, three games, then say, okay, I can identify what's wrong, what I need to do over the off season, and then let's take it from there. That's fine. If it's just an evaluation thing. If for some weird Craig Anderson-esque reason he thinks he's going to come back and, you know, keep contributing to this team and pushing them higher in the standings, and he's really not feeling up to it, then, you know, why bother?
Yeah, I think I actually kind of agree with you. If it's one of these things where he just wants to get back, get into a handful of games and play at like game pace and game intensity just to see how it feels, so that when it comes time to maybe make a decision on his playing future this offseason, he kind of knows what he has to do to get ready if he decides to continue playing, or he basically knows that there's no way he can continue playing given how it may hold up over an 82-game schedule, I'm okay with that.
Yeah, it may not be the worst thing in the world, especially considering where we are in the calendar right now in March. The guy hasn't played since when?
I want to say like January, maybe.
Yeah, so, and there's, again, he's not going to be playing in the World Championship this year. At least I hope not, unless his back is suddenly all right. I'd hope that he'd put that aside. But he's had no All-Star commitments this year. Not that that's a huge one or anything, but it's still another game under your belt. No Olympics and no World Championships. I mean, that could be a long, long, long period of 10 months of rest for him to get himself in shape for next year, which might not be the worst thing in the world at this point.
Yeah, I think my only issue is looking where we are in the standings. He's obviously been ailing all year. It's been visible when you're watching games that he's been ailing since probably the end of October. And I think that the counterpoint to that is, as much as you'd like to have the guy on the ice, test it out and see really how far he can push it in terms of moving forward, it's like, at this point in the year, with where we are in the standings, like, what's the point? It feels like one of those injuries where all it'll take is just one, like, you know, re-aggravation, and he's done.
Yep. One simple.
And I just think, like, it's a very high-risk situation to put himself in for not much payoff.
Yeah, and the other thing that bothers me, you know, a lot about the idea of Daniel Alfredsson coming back is that when he gets reintroduced to the roster, he's going to be taking precious minutes away from guys like Lessard.
Oh, and, yeah.
and
this,
you know,
is an important issue and that we should discuss further, I think.
And my biggest issue with Alfie is the lack of body checking, right? And
They need more body checking.
And Lessard brings the body checking.
Yeah.
Every game,
they
right?
got to get more body checking.
The hugging, the body checking, the yelling, the spitting, all those things he's great at. And Alfie's just going to push him even further into the depths of Ottawa's professional ranks. I mean, the next thing they're going to have to do with the guy is promote him to assistant GM.
I was on Twitter, actually, and when the news kind of broke that Alfredsson was possibly going to be making an appearance at some point during the last, seven games. And one of the questions I asked Ian Mendez, who I believe was the first to post the news, was, well, why isn't the team asking? Why doesn't the team shut him down? Like, what is in it? What's in the team's best interest to... And his response was that Alfredsson's the kind of player who needs to feel good. He wants to end the season on a good note. If he has like that lingering doubt as he's going through his training in the summer, that's the worst. He hates that. So it's more from a personal standpoint for Alfredsson that he wants to get back out there and test his hip and then see where he's at. Does he need surgery to fix it? Is this going to be like a recurring, nagging, chronic injury that's going to bother him for the rest of his career? It's baseless to even speculate as to this point, but if it bothers him that much now, I wonder if retirement's in the cards.
Yeah, and like that's a great sentiment for Alfredsson to express that, or for Mendes to express it on his behalf based on his character. But at the end of the day, the guy's a professional athlete. I want to hear those kind of remarks from every single person in the NHL. You know, no one wants to end the season on a sour note. Everyone wants to, you know, understand that they can contribute next year and that they're going to be, you know, comfortable contributing next year. And, you know, that's great lip service for Alfredsson to pay to the city of Ottawa and to its fans. But ultimately, there's a big picture here. And, you know, if you have to go 6 months of self-doubt as the longest serving captain in the NHL, then, you know, so be it.
Yeah, and I think the issue, too, is, in my opinion, a guy who is probably a first-ballot Hall of Famer in Daniel Alfredsson, I mean, when you're that skilled, and I think most of the decline in performance this year has been related to injury and not so much, like, that old-age decline, it's probably extremely frustrating for him to be, you know, like, I think if in his head he's saying, if I can get myself to a point where I can be healthy enough to perform, like, I can still bring something to the table on this team. But, and Swedish connection aside, I kind of see this as starting to develop into some sort of a Peter Forsberg type situation where this this back or the hip or whatever it is turns into one of these. Well, he'll come back for a few games, test it out, or I see this maybe going this way, where you have a guy who's extremely frustrated because he knows he can still play at a high level, but physically it's like he's can't quite get there. But oh, if he rested a little bit more and then comes back a little bit long, you know, and it just might eventually just kind of fizzle. Yeah. I don't know. Well, I hope not.
It'd be uber depressing if your last recollection of Alfie is seeing a broken player who looks nothing like the player that you grew up watching for the past, what, like 15 years?
Hi, I'm a Pedro Martinez fan. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
It hurts, right? It's ugly to watch anyone who has the skills but just does not have the conditioning, or their conditioning has just failed them over years of abuse.
Oh, I blame fucking John Paddock. Playing that guy like 26, 27 minutes a night in the first half of their 07-08 season, I'm sure that was a contributing factor. Like, if you look at all those players, has any one of those players like had like longevity going for them? Like, Danny Healy hasn't really been the same player since he left town.
No, he hasn't.
Spezza has had a couple of like chronic injuries. He's had a bad back. Alfredson's been broken down every season since then.
Yeah. That's a really good point. And it's sort of like the Dusty Baker. You remember that Cubs year where Baker just, with Kerry Wood and Mark Pryor, just...
I was going to bring up Pryor earlier. He always gets brought up on this show. But yeah, exact same thing, right? Just freaking putting them through the motions.
Yeah.
Game in, game out, and it's going to destroy them. I mean, I guess Mark Pryor's still kicking around in the league. Kerry Wood's what? Anyways.
Well, shells, Woods, yeah.
He's shells of the Cubs, their former selves.
Yeah, yeah. And they were never, ever the same after that year. Yeah. Neither of them.
And those guys were just young. Imagine if they were able to contribute for 10 years and then went through these problems. It would almost be even more difficult to stomach.
Well, we've kind of been talking for a while, so how about we just take like a quick 5-minute break, go grab a drink, and then we'll jump back in the studios and record some more.
2-for-1 ginger ales.
Yeah, okay. Stay tuned, listeners. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Sixth Sense Podcast. Sticking with the Senators before you took that little break. Tim Murray came out this past week, actually. He was on the Healthy Scratches Team 1200 radio program. And over the past few weeks, I've kind of personally expressed concern that the organization might be tempted to rush a player or prospect that we draft in this year's draft. And we shouldn't use their draft position as the only basis for justifying having that player on the roster. I figured if they did something of that nature, it'd be strictly for public relations, driven primarily by selling some tickets and building the hype around a good young team to move forward with. And he came out and he kind of, I forget the exact quote, but he said that although he feels that 2 or 3 of the 4 picks could actually come in and play next year, he doesn't have reservations. But he said he'll do whatever is in the best interest of this organization.
That's completely fair. I don't see any reason that you would want to rush such a valuable asset if it didn't need to be rushed. There's no pressing case for that piece to be on the team next year, except for to generate some excitement. Then I think that's going about it the wrong way. And if that's the nature of their rebuild, they said they wanted to do it right. If they're going to do it right, then the best path is whatever's best for that prospect. And if that means another year in the O and dominating at World Juniors or the W or whatever it may be, that's what you do.
The last thing you want to do is bring a prospect up and take away precious ice time from Francis Lessard.
Oh, yeah. Like, that's massive. He's still got years left.
Yeah. Like, we're talking about a cornerstone building block of the franchise here, you know? And you're telling me we're going to bring up some unpolished, unfinished kid to take away valuable minutes from a guy like Francis Lessard, who just brings everything to the table?
And more locker room problems, because you know Lessard's going to scrap the guy in training camp for the minutes, so it's going to get ugly, right? I mean, you better hope Hopkins can hug with the best of them, because...
Francis Lessard is just taking like a Jim O'Brien-level beating on the show today.
Jimmy goes down... Francis comes up. It's perfect. I love it.
So we've kind of seen some trial basis. Guys who were either picked up on waivers or were called up to give him like a look-see for next season. A few of the prospects I thought of like stood out, guys like Condra and Greening. They've played well.
My boy, Eric Condra.
Can we keep Butler involved in this conversation too?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think far too often he's excluded from these debates. But yeah, definitely those three guys have been fantastic.
I think they've performed quite well. Marek Svatos is another player who's kind of brought in on a trial base, another player who had some ties to Corey Clouston, dating back to their junior days with Kootenay. And he's, I think he just scored this afternoon again, so I think he has two goals now for the Senators.
In limited.
And he's scored those two goals over the past, what, four games? Because I know he was goalless for 10 or 12 games there for, yeah.
And Curtis McElhinney is another who's performed, you know, reasonably well, given his small sample size of games. And, well, we've already re-signed Craig Anderson. So my question to you is, it looks, assuming that a prospect who is drafted as, like, you know, a top six kind of forward isn't rushed next season, is there a player out there available who you guys would kind of target in free agency?
Personally, looking at the roster as it stands right now, unless you're going to start moving pieces from the wing, or you know, some of your lower centers, then there's really not much use in it unless you don't feel that an internal asset can fill that roster spot. I'm not really overly comfortable with that idea.
It's interesting though. Like, I'm perusing this list of free agents right now, Tim, and there's not a ton of available, like, top six talent that you'd want to bring in. And
well, what's the purpose of bringing in a free agent at its most basic level? It's to improve a team.
Well,
or improve the quality of your product without filling that spot internally, right?
Well, it depends. I think if you could sign, you know, to a couple of these underachieving vets, maybe to, like, short, low-risk contracts, if those guys, if they can become, like, you know, valuable players down the stretch, and then you peddle them at the deadline to accrue more draft picks and prospects, then I think that's a shrewd route to take if you're Brian Murray.
Yeah, like, as much as I love the idea of bringing in a Brad Richards or an... you know, or a Parise or someone of that nature, like, in, you know, just flip to HF boards and have a look at all the absolutely mind-blowingly stupid discussion that occurs there surrounding these players and among other things at large. Hey, by the way, did you see that thread about Kyle Turris?
No.
Yep, someone jacked your idea.
Son of a bitch.
Absolutely. But, you know, you don't bring in Bill Gates to be the CEO of a startup, right? So... you know, unless the team thinks they're going to be ready to compete after acquiring enough assets this offseason, then what's the point? Why bother flushing away the money on a competitive player on a non-competitive team?
Ville Leino is an interesting name.
He is. He's had success everywhere he's been to. He's got a wicked playoff beard.
Modest success, though. Like, we should know, like, get ourselves...
Where would he play if he was on the Senators?
He'd probably be a second liner.
Well, second line left winger, maybe?
Success.
Ryan Shannon's a second line center on this team, though. Like,
by default,
yeah. Well, no, Peter like, Egan's I mean, a guy I who mean, comes with, back, though.
With a guy like Leino, I mean, his cap hit this year is $800,000. Probably not a guy Philadelphia is going to keep, just because they can bring in someone else comparable for less or whatever it is. Kind of an intriguing name. I mean, I'm not suggesting we give the guy big time money, but if he's there, sort of. After the market kind of somewhat dries up after the first couple days of free agent frenzy, like, Ville Leino is an interesting name.
Yeah, I think that would become even more interesting if it made a name like Nick Foligno or Peter Regan expendable.
Yeah,
as
absolutely.
Well. Unfortunately, you can only have so many of those players, like we talked about off the air with NCAA free agents. You can only have so many of them because they only fill a certain need generally. Absolutely.
It's interesting, though, because some of his comments made after Craig Anderson signed his extension, Brian Murray essentially alluded to Anderson is a recruiting tool for free agents.
What? Like, who though?
Well, he's building from the back out, right? I think that's his recruiting tool, is that now he can say, like, he's not going to go out and blow the bank on, you know, some garbage lifer defenseman from Buffalo. So, you know, we have the goaltenders, kind of. We have an established NHL goaltender, a nice prospect in the system in Lehner. Maybe we'll get another goalie in the draft this year. I think the defense is more than set for a few years now. Anything we get now is just going to be... excess.
But looking at the markets over the course of the next, what, two or three years, there's not abundance of great talent that's going to be, like, hitting the market. So it's like,
unless there are RFAs, right? Well, which is something he did allude to when he said that maybe we can pick up a player that another team can't afford, a la Chicago, right? Like, for every cap casualty, there's going to be a cap benefactor as well, right?
We do have two first round picks this year, so who knows? Like you're saying, if someone feels like they're not going to be able to afford one of their RFAs, or I don't know, if you can trade that first round pick and maybe something else, or if you could trade that, like, I trade that first round pick for a guy like Drew Stafford if Buffalo felt they couldn't afford him.
Yep.
Like, that's a legitimate top six forward, and in the middle first round you're probably not going to draft anyone whose ceiling is higher than, say, a Drew Stafford anyways, so you're getting a legitimate, I mean, I think Stafford's on pace to score over 30 goals this year. So there's a guy you could play with Spezza. I mean, and you don't have to wait that 2 years or whatever for him to develop. He's only 25 years old. So something like that, getting creative and doing something like that, I'm totally for that too, if you can bring in someone who can make an immediate contribution.
Absolutely, and I think that second first-round pick that we own right now, especially if Nashville somehow manages to slip the playoffs and that was looking like a 15th overall pick, that's going to look pretty attractive to a team in the 25 to 30 range who maybe has these RFAs who they're not going to be able to afford due to an influx of talent versus cash who has built properly. And, you know, that could be a nice piece just to kind of sustain your hockey program, right?
Yeah, because, I mean, let's face it, we're in a market, and this is the unfortunate part, we're in a market where we have to have like a quasi-competitive team on a year-in, year-out basis if we're going to generate ticket sales. Like, that's just the kind of the ugly truth of being...
And we're not alone in
a hockey team. No, we're not alone in that at all. And what I'm thinking is, you know what? Maybe that second first round pick, as much as it's sexy to like draft a whole bunch of talent when you're like so-called rebuilding, maybe that second first round pick we have could be better used to acquire the rights to a legitimate RFA. Like, I mean, I keep using the name Drew Stafford, but someone comparable to that you can bring in and can fill a slot on that top six right away.
So with the second first round pick, would either of you guys be opposed to, say, the Senators finish on, you know, fourth overall and we end up, you know, getting a bum deal in the lottery and end up drafting fifth overall? Would you guys be opposed to trading the Nashville pick as well as ours to move up so the Senators can get the guy that they want?
Well, we were talking about this on the car ride over, the possibility that we could pass Florida in the standings, move up higher, and obviously you get the deteriorating lottery odds that go with that. And I think Ottawa is in a good situation in which they can afford to parlay maybe like a few of those second-round picks just to get up, get the player that they want. If they, in the past, like looking at Erik Karlsson, that's another player that they targeted, and they made that trade to get the guy that they wanted. And if there's a guy in the top five that they really like, I don't foresee that being a problem or an issue. And the one thing, I think the best case scenario for the Senators right now is if Nashville finishes out of the playoffs, wins the lottery with that 0.5% chance, that pick moves up four spots, and Ottawa keeps their pick. And I for whatever reason, it's baseless speculation, but I think Ottawa's going to try and move up with that Nashville pick too.
Well, we've heard Pierre Dorion say that the team prefers quality over quantity, obviously, as they should. But when you hear things like that, especially leading up to the draft, it kind of makes you wonder if they're not going to take, you know, their glut of draft picks. I mean, how many contracts can you actually dole out? Like, how many draft picks do we have this year?
Ooh, I think it's like, what, six in the top 65 or something like that?
And then...
plus a possible conditional coming from Nashville if they advance in the playoffs.
Yeah, like that's a big influx of players into your system. Obviously not directly into your system. A lot of these guys have, probably haven't even gone to university yet who may consider that route. So it could be 4 years, but still.
Here's a question for you. Looking back at this Craig Anderson deal, like a lot of people, including myself, criticized the deal in terms of the time and the subsequent contract that he signed for, is saying, well, you know, that's, you know, maybe it is a small cap hit. That's the kind of deal that you think could have gotten the deal done on July 1st had he never played a game in this city. Do you think Murray made a lot of these trades now, like moving guys that he had to not necessarily move at the time, guys like Campoli or Mike Fisher or Chris Kelly for second round picks to accrue kind of like a wealth of, call it maybe insurance in case Ottawa slid in the standings so they would have those assets to move?
Yep,
just to cover their own ass?
That's entirely possible. I actually think that's quite possible. And as well, like you're talking about Anderson's contract, maybe he would have signed that on July 1st, but as we all know, Anderson's going to be the free agent lure for the Senators for years to come. So maybe if they do have their eye on someone this year, having Anderson out of the way nice and early as a benchmark along with Lessard to attract players, knowing that they'll be safe and turn out the year with a positive plus minus, that's what you do.
You haven't been here in a couple of weeks. Who do you want them to take in the top five?
I flip-flopped amongst all the players, Strom, Larson, Landeskog, Hopkins, Couturier, Huberto, all these guys. I think ultimately Hopkins looks like the guy with the nice ceiling. He plays center. You can never go wrong with having, you know, top two line centers. His size is a bit of a concern, but I think size is overvalued on draft day. I've kind of come to the conclusion that Couturier and Landeskog may not be the offensive catalysts that we're hoping them to be. But really, like I saw someone had posted this list of the top 10 draft picks over the past 10 years. It's really such a crapshoot. I can't get the image of Patrick Stefan in that ugly jersey out of my head right now. But like, the number, there's nothing wrong with the number two pick. Look what happened with Jeff Skinner. I know there's always going to be one of those guys every year. You can always find someone in the seventh round who outproduces a first round pick. But I've got faith in the Sens' drafting abilities. If Tim Murray and Pierre Dorion feel that there's like a tier of seven or eight players that they like right off the bat, and we're going to get one of them, all the better. I mean, you really can't call yourself an expert on these guys, no matter how much you read, no matter how many games you stream throughout the year, how many times you go visit the 67s when these guys are in town. You just can't get a read on it. People's draft rankings are all over the place. I was looking back at the McKenzie's 2010 draft rankings, and the
before and after.
Yeah, and the result of it, especially like the preseason ones, the midseason ones, it just fluctuates so much. And you can ask me what my stance is on hurt conditions. I can give you an opinion, but it's not going to be right. None of us know. That's the big thing. None of us know.
I think they should just draft somebody to get some more body checking.
Oh yeah, the fighting and the body checking.
Yeah.
That's how you win, man.
That's how you win. I think like I've flip-flopped a lot too, and at one point I was pretty high on Couturier because I was like, well, you know what? Like he's pretty established center and stuff like that, but
and he beat out Hopkins for that spot on Team Canada, killing the queue.
Yeah, yeah.
You
can make a case for Couturier too, but I think right now I'm kind of settling into my preference would be Nugent. I'm assuming Larson's going first overall to the Oilers. So my preference would be Nugent Hopkins, and then I would probably go Landeskog, Strom, Huberdeau, Couturier. And that would be sort of how my preference.
I've always been give me the guy with the highest ceiling. And yep. Then, doesn't necessarily have to be the best player next year. It has to be the best player, five, six, 10 years down the road?
Like the Royals drafted Luke Hochaver when they could have drafted like Justin Upton or something, or BJ Upton, or
yeah, but that also that also
like
has
they
to
drafted
do,
like the guy that they thought they could sign you, or like the Padres with Matt Bush.
Baseball is completely different.
Pitchers
though, with
their take draft. Longer to develop.
Signability has such a huge
a
huge impact on that baseball draft. That
are you now, or have you ever been affiliated with Scott Boras?
There's not really an agent in hockey though that you can actually attribute to being like that power, the power broker
controls
everything.
What's his name? You have Boris
Ari.
In baseball, and then you have
Ari
who's
Gold.
The asshole with the squeaky voice in football there.
T.O.'s
guy. It's the name's escaping me. Come on, Tim.
I'm not good with agents. I know J.P. Barry and Stacey McAlpine. We've discussed Jay Grossman on the air before.
Alan Walsh is pretty predominant. No?
Whenever I see his...
Drew Rosenhaus.
That's exactly who it is.
Next question. Next question.
T.O.'s cranking out sit-ups shirtless in his driveway, and you got Rosenhaus.
Next question.
Oh, God.
So I think one thing we can all agree on with the draft is that BPA, right? Everyone?
Yeah. We've been kind of like championing that idea the whole year, whether it's Larson or whatever.
The one thing that always strikes me is that the Senators have been so unpredictable on draft day over the past few years. The Carlson move up, the Rundblad trade, Cowan sliding and us nabbing him after that, elaborate Brian Burke discussion with Brian Murray about a player that they both want. Fine. So I think it may be, maybe this is the year we should expect the expected with them, and they take the big Canadian kid or the big kid that Brian Murray wants so badly, right? Like we heard about the discussions that went on when the Senators went to draft Erik Karlsson, and Brian Murray's reservations at drafting this kid who looks like he should be serving the fries at the draft, not participating in it. And, what a hard time it is to sell it when he just wants the big body Canadian in the mid rounds. With the body checking.
The body checking that comes with the big body. Of course.
Pierre Dorion was on the radio earlier in the season. And one of the things that he said, he made mention of John Tavares' draft year. And he said, well, a lot of experts and pundits and scouting services have their own independent rankings. And he's like, those are nice. And usually you can get some kind of like broad consensus on like where players should go. He's like, but look, NHL teams don't adhere to that. Like John Tavares might have been number one on many people's list, but he's like, we had Duchene as the number one guy in that draft. So where guys slot right now doesn't mean anything. And it goes back to what you were saying. There's so much variance in the way that these prospects play over the next couple weeks.
And the interesting thing about that is that Tavares was the consensus number one, right? Amongst all these publications and these, you know, Bob McKenzie doing his evaluation from the scouts and all this crap. And here we go. Pierre Dorion saying that they actually had him at number two. Weird. Who'd have ever thought?
I don't even think he said that he had him at number two because Hedman was there too. So yeah, he just said, like, Duchesne would have been the guy that we would have taken.
And
so
had they had the first overall pick.
Yeah.
And Kane, I'd imagine at that time, would have been, a nice looking option for the Senators who were forward hungry for years. Yeah.
Well, with the body checking.
The body checking. To compliment the Jim O'Brien body checking.
Between Lassard and the body checking, you guys are just flying through this material.
But that's kind of encouraging to say that you would when you said Dorion said that they had Duchesne as the number one guy, because I think what that tells you is they're doing their homework, and it seems like they have guys slotted right about where they're supposed to go.
Of course, it all could have been lip service, and Duchesne looks like the best player available now.
Yeah,
so,
of course, too. Yeah,
it's so great when no one knows what's happening, you can come out and say, "Oh yeah, we had him number one, absolutely."
You mentioned something earlier that I wanted to hit on, but it...
Oh, it was the body checking.
No, it definitely wasn't the body checking. But you were talking about players that the Senators could possibly target. And looking at, guys who've been around the league, we've made mention of, Michael Boudker and Kyle Turris in Phoenix. But, those are the kind of young, cheap players who are kind of trending down that you might be able to, snag. Because Ottawa's they have that luxury where they could afford to parlay maybe some assets to get these guys in and allow them to, develop with those minutes, right, that we're giving to guys like Ryan Shannon right now.
But Oscar Moeller being another one.
Yeah, Oscar Moeller in LA is another one who's probably going to have a wicked opportunity to play now that Anze Kopitar's out for the foreseeable future with a broken leg.
Like, there's a whole group of guys who could, raise their hands to appear on the Island of Lost Toys, right?
No, exactly.
Torres,
Cody Hodgson.
Yep, exactly. Like, these are guys who, maybe some of them belong on the Island of Lost Toys, but certainly there's going to be a few guys on there who are going to make it out and who just didn't develop at, 19, 20, 21 years old in the AHL. Just took him a little bit longer. Like, look at Jim O'Brien having success now.
Oh, he's definitely years. I mean, he's definitely the train with the caboose with the square wheels. Because he can't skate to save his life, right? So,
but certainly, if you do your homework and you hope that your professional scouting is as good as your amateur scouting, and you can identify a guy who has maybe been miscast by his current organization. Andrew Cogliano springs to mind as well. Seems to be a lot of small, fast, undersized.
Sam Gagner is another.
Yep, exactly.
I think Sam Gagner is the type of guy that could look really good in the right situation, though, too. I just don't think he's in a very good situation to succeed right now.
It's so hard to
imagine.
That
guy's I see that guy as being his upside could be Danny Briere comparable, if surrounded with the right amount of talent. But I might be wrong on this, but...
Oh, I was actually going to say Patrick Kane.
Yeah.
So, I think those guys are just,
infinitely talented, just...
People don't rip the O up in this day and age. Obviously, there's the Dag and the Mike Hoffman, references there. But you just do not kill those leagues anymore.
Those are some stacked London teams, though.
No, yeah. But I mean, Perry's gone on to great success. Mike Richards ripped up the O. A lot of those guys. It's like you're saying. That's not a fluke to put up that. Regardless if you're playing on a stacked team or not, that's not a fluke to put up that kind of production in the OHL. I mean, even Tavares ripped it up. I mean, Tavares doesn't have the skill set to be an absolute Hall of Fame superstar in the NHL, but he's a damn effective player in the NHL. He's a legitimate top six guy. I have a hard time believing Sam Gagner his upside is not higher than what we've seen so far in Edmonton. So,
yep, just like Kyle Turris, especially when you see his ice time. I've really enjoyed watching the broadcast recently when you start hearing about, guys like Erik Karlsson, Chris Phillips chasing down the green jacket for the end of the year. How have I never heard this expression before in hockey? That's incredible.
That is good.
And the guys who have the Cy Young careers, Milan Mihalik, obviously maybe not so much this year, but, going 22-5 for a grand total of 27 points, shooting percentage under one. So as we talk about Islands of Lost Toys here, do you think, someone like Peter Regan or Nick Foligno could be,
exiled?
Exchanged nicely for a piece like this?
Well, even Regan, I think, fits into that category of young kind of guys who could possibly be top six guys. I know Francois is not really high on him.
Well, I don't think he belongs in the same discussion as a lot of the other guys we've put in that.
Well, no.
Category.
Those guys have pedigree. Yeah. But I was
really high on him last year. I think I even named him as one of my breakout players for this year, much like a lot of other Sens fans.
I went with Kovalev, so.
but I think right now I'll just eat my humble pie. I think Peter Regan is. He's just not going to make it. I mean,
you know what his problem is?
He's Vados in 5 years.
It's upper body strength. If that guy adds some size and just some strength, he could be an effective player. It's just he loses so many battles.
Never shoots the puck enough. I just don't know if he has the luster to be,
an effective player
in the NHL.
I am 100% on the same page with you.
Yeah, like he doesn't do anything really wrong. But at the same time, he doesn't do anything really right. He struggled so badly this year. Like, it was just ugly watching him play for a long time. Like,
I think we've seen what we're going to see from Peter Regan, and I don't think there's much more to expect there.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about some NCAA free agents. We got Paul Thompson, University of New Hampshire. We've got the blowover Goldie Hawn that just walked in next door there. And
speaking of blowover Goldie Hawn.
Is that the female comb over right there?
Oh fuck. I have to address this. I actually bumped into our friend Gilligan there with the Bill Clinton cigar tube gestures in a random location, and he was wearing a CKCU toque. Blew my mind.
I recall him.
He was quite the distraction. We're losing it just thinking about him right now.
I think we should have had include that in the intro to the Island of Lost Toys. We're talking about that guy. Jeez.
Blow over Goldie Hawn. She used the Flowbee to do her hair this morning.
What do you call that do? Oh, I call it the OC Transpo blow by. As in I woke up on it then got kicked off of it.
Oh man!
So, do we want to make any predictions here about collegiate free agents? Maybe some guys of note.
Well, Tim Murray said last week that they were still in on a few players. Stefan DaCosta from Merrimack College being one of them. Whether anything comes to fruition, who knows? Thompson, the guy that you mentioned, he was what, Bobby Butler's linemate?
Certainly teammate.
Teammate. So maybe there's a connection there. So yeah. Cross your fingers that maybe they can sign one or two of these guys. And then at the worst, you fill a void at the AHL level for some of these guys that you've called up who might play next season. So it's just a cheap, effective way to restock your system perpetually. So if you can do that like every year and add one or two guys.
Nope. Absolutely agree with you. And I think that's a reasonable remark considering our knowledge of the players, just the situations they're in. But do you guys think that Ottawa is a good destination for collegiate players? Do they have strong negotiating power with these players, considering their, readiness to introduce collegiate grads into the NHL and relatively quickly, depending on their success in the A? Do you think that bodes well for us?
Well, since we've lost Chris Kelly, I think it's important for the organization to add as much IQ as possible.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The IQ and the body checking.
You can never have enough body checking. Too much body checking.
Well, you got to have the high IQ so you know when to lay the body checking and when to, lay the headshot instead of the body checking.
Exactly.
At least Lassard hasn't gotten suspended and ended up on the... that's the last thing we need is the Sen jersey on the lead story of CNN hockey violence special.
You know what, though? Honestly, of anyone in the league that... let's be honest. If you had three picks, I'm pick three players around the NHL that's just gonna lay the most ridiculously obliterating headshot. Like Lassard has to be up there. I'm gonna go out there and make an impact, just fucking crush a guy's head with his elbow into the stanchion or something,
I'm gonna get noticed today is what he's been thinking.
Yeah,
for 48
exactly.
hours.
Yeah. I have to do something big.
Someone on Twitter told me to do this, and I'm going to. I searched up most watched hockey videos on YouTube, and Bertuzzi came up first, so I guess that's what I do. All right, do we have a moment here since we're going around the NHL anyways? Anyone have a few thoughts, very short thoughts, on Chera and the hit, the body checking hit?
Yeah, I think, well, my position on it is, first of all, I think it's just one of those things where it was wrong time, wrong place, wrong player, sort of just because he's so much bigger. But Zdeno Chara is not a dirty player. We've seen him, you know, we've seen his body of work firsthand here when he plays for Sens. He's not a dirty player. He's a physically imposing player. And he uses his physicality, I think, very effectively for a big man. My issue is, I think it's just one of those unfortunate things that happens, you know, the speed of the game and whatever. And people, I think the big argument is, well, Chara should have been aware of his surroundings. But Pacioretty is carrying the puck. He's skating in a straight line. He sees that lane closing up. Like, where is the awareness on Pacioretty's behalf to be like, okay, this guy's going to crunch me against the boards, like, slow up? Or he tried to squeeze by in a lane that was closing up against the biggest player in the NHL. Like, this sounds really bad, but I think, like, some of the onus in that situation has to be placed on Pacioretty as well. I think that goes both ways in terms of realizing where you are on the ice. And I'm not saying Pacioretty should have known that the turnbuckle is there. What I'm saying is you are half the size of a guy that has you in his... I mean, you have to protect yourself in that situation. Chip the puck by him, do what you have to do, slow up, whatever. Don't skate in a straight line into a lane that's closing up with the biggest player in the NHL lining you up for a hit, right?
Protect yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I completely agree. I thought you were going to go in the opposite direction with your, your unpopular stance, but I 100% agree with you there. Just a bad situation, wrong time, wrong place. It happened. It was ugly. It just so happened it was in Montreal by the biggest player in the NHL. It happens. You move on. That's hockey. Far worse things happen on the ice in hockey than that hit. If they want to get away from the intent to injure and, you know, the intent to remove players from the game through force, then, you know, that hit could not have been further away from those ideas. I don't think that Chara was out there thinking, yeah, I'm going to, you know, mix in some WWF here and just drive this guy into the turnbuckle. There's no way. Chara, you know, if he wanted to, he just drop the gloves and one punch him and you have a broken face for a month, right? Like, that's how it goes. That's not Chara's game. It just happened. I was so happy that they didn't cave to Montreal pressure. I cannot believe that those idiots were calling 911 in Montreal, tying up phone lines for the police for real emergencies over a friggin' hockey hit. And now they've got to waste even more dollars having the police investigate it because it was a 911 call. Absolutely ridiculous. I am so happy that everyone has had the opportunity to hang their hat on this issue and to define themselves, and TSN has had so much to talk about, so sick of it. Fine hit.
Yeah, and just kind of going back to it as well, the outcome is really unfortunate. And you know what? Had it not been for that outcome, Chara makes an incredibly smart hockey play. He's prepared to take a 2-minute interference call to stop an odd man rush. And it just so happened that Pacioretty got pasted into the turnbuckle. I thought it was, like, he makes, I think in that situation where you have to go, okay, I'm either going to get beat or I have to do something to stop a scoring opportunity, he makes a smart play.
Yep,
Nine times out of ten, I would rather have him make that decision. And if it ends up as unfortunately as it did, it's really too bad. But I think that if I'm Claude Julien in that situation, nine times out of ten, I want Chara making that exact same play.
It's like Mark Recchi said, right? I mean, like, it was a bad hit, but you know, the guy was out of the movie theater after. I mean, we've heard these stories about these guys spending days and days and days in dark rooms trying to recover from concussions. Certainly the last thing you're going to do if you have if your really brains are really scrambled, like Mark Savard, is go out and take in Avatar in 3D at the theater to kill some time between the game. And I know it's wrong to talk about a player in that sense when they are, you know, seriously injured. Anything involving the neck and the spine is terrible. But it's happened before. It's going to happen again.
There was intent to hurt. I don't think there was intent to break his neck. There's a line.
Intent to hurt. It's body checking, Graham.
No. I know, but I mean, like, he saw the stanchion there.
Yeah.
Like, he knew exactly where he was on the ice.
Everyone knows where that is on the ice, and everyone knows the Bell Center has a bad one.
And, you know, like, Chara's a 6'9" guy, and I know, like, a lot of people said, oh, he's targeted in the head, but, like, he pushed him from the side, and whenever you push someone and you're pushing with force, you finish with your hand up. You never push and then push down because you get no leverage doing that. So it's just an unfortunate circumstance where you have a guy who's like 6'7", almost 7 feet tall on skates, and he's pushing a much physically smaller player into just an area where he was vulnerable, and it was just a dangerous area for the hit, and it happened. Like, I wouldn't suspend him either for the hit. I thought it was, I don't think what Chera did was like egregiously offensive from a hockey perspective. It's just an unfortunate circumstance that happened. Even in the games that followed, later that week, I think there was a Drew Doughty hit in the stanchion as well. Like, I think like the next night, and there were a couple others.
Well, they're all the rage now, right? Yeah. I mean, after you see Chera do it, everyone's got to put someone in the turnbuckle.
Oh, yeah, you got to use the body checking to put someone in the turnbuckle.
It's the new hot thing this season. Last year, it was all about the headshots. That's so passe. Now it's about the turnbuckle.
The worst was like, was it James Wisniewski that was like just disgusted by the hit? Do you not remember that flying fucking Superman that he just like smashed Seabrook?
Seabrook, yeah.
Like, oh, Wisniewski shouldn't be saying anything about that hit. Like, his was the intent behind his was just so much worse than what Chera did. Like,
well,
that
he's
was
a classic guy.
Wisniewski?
Oh, he's a class act.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's his little family friendly act there towards Sean Avery. What a joke. here, bag my groceries. Thank you.
Well, he's probably pissed that he received a longer suspension for doing that than Chera did.
Yeah, that's true. It's a good way of looking at it, but
c'est la vie.
It wasn't the fashionable crime at the time.
One thing I wanted to do hit on, actually, before we left, was Patrick Kuchar. We haven't really hit on him whatsoever. How would you assess his last three games?
Decent, better, and then a little bit better.
Yeah, that's fair. I have nothing to add. It's looking okay, though.
Well, I'm glad I asked a question, then.
Yeah, it's looking okay, though.
Well, he hasn't taken Russia in a week or anything, but he's been all right. He's been just fine. He's showing all the right signs of being a competent NHL player. He was admittedly quite nervous entering his first NHL game, as most people would be, and playing one of the most difficult positions in the NHL as a young kid, especially one who hasn't filled out as much as he should have. I think he's handled himself quite well. I thought he played a hell of a game against Washington, including taking that hit and getting up from it eventually as well. We often talk about guys who have better NHL projections than they do in the AHL. Wierkosh may be one of those kids. I like him on this team. Probably not next year. He may get a cup of coffee or two. But certainly in 2 to 3 years, we can be looking at Pat Wierkosh on the blue line without any problems. And we better hope so, because we need another, if you want to go with one skill and one tower of power on defense, like it looks like they're gearing up for, what better thing to have than Patrick Wierkosh on your third pairing, playing with a guy like, Phillips or Greiba or whoever it happens to be, right?
Yeah, and I mean, can you imagine once he develops his body checking at the NHL level?
Shit.
Beaten to death. Beaten to death, lads.
People will just forget about Chera. Once we are Kalash gets the body checking down.
Oh, God. Awesome episode, guys.
I think I'm pretty much good to go.
I think we just talked for about 40 minutes in that second half of the podcast.
Oh,
dude.
Yeah,
unless we're going to debate the size of parking spots at Scotiabank.
Yeah, let's
wrap this up.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Tim, nice to see you in the studios again. Hopefully we'll see you again soon.
Back next week to talk some Francis Lessard, give some updates on, I guess by then he'll have played 9 minutes of hockey over the past week. So
we'll have a good sample size.
Absolutely.
Good stuff. All right, guys. Thanks to our listeners for listening to the show, and we'll catch you again soon. Thanks.
Later.